really just feeling that. That was so beautiful. So beautiful. Honey, could we do that later? You play guitar, I sing. We could do that, right? Right? No. They don't want to hear me sing. They hear me sing enough. So, good morning. I'm all excited because I'm presenting a message today that might sound a little bit familiar because I did a talk 2 or 3 or 4 weeks ago that has a similar theme. But what I want you to know is what I'm saying today is brand new. And what I'm delivering today in terms of a message for all of us is something that I feel quite passionate about. And I notice that when it comes up in class, I'm always working to help people see a broader idea of what it is because I think it is one of the most misunderstood words in this idea of spiritual community. So today I'm talking about humility. Yeah, take a breath. I'm going to talk about humility that is a way that is quite different than the way I approached it a few weeks ago when we spoke about theological pretentiousness, which, by the way, was a good intro into this. But this message today is not an adjunct to that. It is a standalone message because I have something very powerful to say that I think is sort of a missing piece in spirituality, generally speaking. And I have felt passionately about that for a long, long time, and I have not understood quite why. And I think I figured it out, and so I'm going to share all of that with you today. I notice that most of the conversations we would have anywhere, not just in spiritual community, not just on a Sunday morning sitting in a church, but most of the conversations we have around this idea of being humble are sort of married or attached or woven together with some feelings of heaviness, some guilt. They're sort of this way it's laced with this idea that there is a way we should be behaving as opposed to a way we should not be behaving. And so even if you look at the dictionary definition of humility, what you find is it speaks to lowliness. It speaks to submissiveness. It talks about the way that being less than so that you do not appear to be arrogant or prideful. That's a lot of shoulds and a lot of implication that I want to approach because what I think when I look at a definition that says that you don't want to appear arrogant or too proud, we're talking about appearances. We're talking about worrying about how we look to other people. And as the spiritual leader of this community, I want to suggest to all of us that let's quit worrying about what other people think about us, and let's find a way to stand in our own integrity in a positive and generous and a kind way as much as possible. We can't do it all the time. We are humans in finite form in these cute little bodies we're wearing almost like clothing here. I remember reading that book by Terry Cole Whitaker years ago, What You Think of Me Is None of My Business, and I felt so liberated when I got done with that reading because it gave me a whole different approach to leading my own life. And so I had a daughter at the time that was about 14 or so, and she was really excited about it, and I'm trying to teach her all this same information, and she took it to a girlfriend of hers at school, one of her best friends, who was very religious, and her friend said, "That's a terrible thing. What you think about me is my business." And I think that was the first time I began to see that there is sort of a religious idea of the way we should not be prideful, that we are always self-imposing so that we don't appear to be whatever that arrogant, prideful appearance is. Let's quit worrying about appearances. I think that's the whole message of Jesus. You know, don't think that the appearance is real. Let's find the greater truth and then let's stand in it. So that's what I'm feeling so much passion about is I want to stand in this message today because it feels very important to me. And in fact, as I started doing some of the research and looking for quotes that would support my sort of inside-out view of all of this, because, you know, I am that person. I'm always looking at things from a slightly different angle. But it does make life fun most days. I found this quote from Emerson, and I thought, no wonder I love Ralph Waldo Emerson. We think alike, because Emerson had this theory that there was a haughtiness to humility. A haughtiness to humility. You know the story of Benjamin Franklin, right? Benjamin Franklin, I learned this through all the Franklin Covey calendar stuff that we used to do. Benjamin Franklin made a list of the qualities in life, the characteristics that he wanted to live up to, sort of setting his intention, and he took his list to his minister and he said, "What do you think about this list that I've created?" And the minister reviewed it and said, "It's great, but you've forgotten one thing. You forgot to put humility on this list." And so he was kind of embarrassed and he added humility at the bottom of his list. And then he went through his whole life. And at the end of his life, he said he realized that humility was not one of his words that he was called to strive toward as a characteristic. That it was what the preacher wanted him to have on the list. So you need to know what your words are. And if indeed you know that there is some pride that you look to balance out in your life, then by all means, that could be your word. My invitation here is for us to have a broader view of what that means. So I found this fabulous quote from a guy named Phillips Brooks. He lived in the 1800s, and he was an Episcopalian clergyman. But what's interesting, because, you know, I never quote people I don't know till I look them up and do a little research, because once in a blue moon, you get a wild character in there that you don't really want to be quoting at church. At least if you're the minister. So I always look up that's why I always have a little background information for you on who I'm quoting. But Phillips Brooks actually is the person who wrote the lyrics for the Christmas carol, "O Little Town of Bethlehem." Isn't that interesting? But listen to this fabulous quote, because I think it defines well the way I am approaching this idea of humility. "The true way to be humble is not to stoop until you are smaller than yourself, but to stand at your real height against some higher nature that will show you what the real smallness of your greatness is." Okay, I'm going to read it one more time because it's so good. I want you to hear it twice. "The true way to be humble is not to stoop until you are smaller than yourself, but to stand at your real height against some higher nature that will show you what the real smallness of your greatness is." Now let's hear an amen. Amen. So I keep thinking of humbleness as standing tall. Standing tall in truth, not appearance, not in trying to be something you haven't quite mastered yet, but standing tall in the greatness that you already are. So the title of my talk this morning is The Humble Emperor, and it's based upon the life of Marcus Aurelius. I noticed early on in my deep dive into spiritual study, I noticed that many quotes crop up by all the savvy authors, the spiritual authors that keep the top 40 list rich with spiritual nonfiction personal growth titles. And Marcus Aurelius was the emperor of the Roman Empire from 161 to 180 AD. He actually shared that leadership for a while with someone else, but he was considered to be the last of the good emperors, and he was a great emperor. I mean, think of it. Whenever I say anything about the Roman Empire, Hugh says, the sun never set on that. They used to say the sun never set. It was so big. The sun never set on the Roman Empire. So Marcus Aurelius was a great leader, but he was also known to be a very demanding person. Can great leaders be demanding? Absolutely, they need to be. And he expected, he had high expectations out of all the people around him. He demanded a high level of excellence in the way they worked with him. But he was also fair, and he was equitable, and he was stable. They say that he had a way of standing stable, even in the middle of some serious conflict. And in fact, he was so good at that, that he could, even in conflict, he could bring guidance and inspiration to other people. Now, one of the reasons he could do that is because he had a clear idea of what it meant to be a strong leader, and he had some clear and specific identification that the power that he used as a dynamic leader was not a power that was his alone. That there was something, some universal power that we might not understand, but that it worked through him. And more than that, that power wanted to succeed through the choices he made as a leader. Isn't that gorgeous? This is, we should be teaching this to ministers in seminary. This is a beautiful description of strong leadership. So Marcus Aurelius wanted to make the world a better place, and that was a unique thing. He wasn't the kind of ruler that was just about fixing the problems and leading people out to do battle. He really had this intention of making the world a better place, and they described him. And I think this is key in our understanding of him. They described him as a man who had a great awe of God, but not a fear of God. So I want you to think about that for a minute. A lot of the decisions I made in my former religious days before I grew to a higher perspective, a different spiritual, a level of spiritual maturity, however you want to call it, but what I know is that what the decisions I made to be a good person were because of the fear of God. You didn't want to displease God. But I notice that as we settle into our spiritual maturity, we no longer serve out of fear. We can begin to serve and stand strong in our authentic place and our beliefs and serve from our heart and serve from that place of love. So Marcus Aurelius was a humble ruler, and he demonstrated a consciousness of humility, but let me tell you why. I think if we take all those things that we just said, it was because he knew his greatness came from something else, from something bigger than he was. He believed that he was guided by this universal power. He believed that the good that he wanted to see on the planet, was the desire of that power that worked through him. So let's talk about the definition of humility. I have this fabulous book that I use quite often when I'm looking at the meaning of words. It's called The Hidden Souls of Words by Mary Cox Garner. I've had it for years and years. I don't even know if you can still get it. But in that book, she takes only about 100 words. I didn't count, I'm guessing. She takes about 100 words, and she gives a spiritual definition of those words. And only twice in the entire book does she pair two words together in order to help understand them. And humility is one time she pairs humility with the word power. The only other instance where she paired two words together were spirituality and politics, which is also a good one. So the reason she put humility and power together is because she believes if you desire to truly understand humility, you have to see it right there next to power, that you can't have one without the other. And so though they sound like contradictory, you could see them as opposites on the end of a pole. You can see it as a polarity. And that when we look at spiritual ideas with two opposing ends, what we see is that that which is in between them is that which creates a divine tension. Right? It brings us, even in our question, scratching our head and going, what? And looking at paradox, we find that those very contradictions are the things that take us deeper in our understanding of spiritual matters. So we can understand some of it from our intellect. And if you want to go much deeper, we surrender that and we look for that place of divine tension where we can put pairs of opposites together and know something magnificent is right in the middle of it. So if we look at the root, the Latin root of humility, it's humus, H-U-M-U-S. You know what that is? Earth, not hummus like the, not like mushed garbanzo beans. Close. Like the earth. It's talking about, the root of that word literally is about the physicality of the earth. So when we look at the definition of humility and it says lowly or submissive, that's because the root of the word is pretty earthy. It's, you know how we say down to earth? I'm accused of that often and I'm not embarrassed by it. I can be down to earth. So there's something natural in that earthiness that is different than the higher thoughts that we might say are heavenly, because we're pairs of opposites, heaven and earth, we could say. So we as human beings are that amazing place of all of that coming together into this great oneness. So sometimes the Bible talked about the earth, the firmament of the earth, and that made me think, yeah, I want to stand firm in that. I want to stand firm on this firmament that is the earth and that which gives us that space of solidness that we stand on in our human life. Unless you live in Southern California, then sometimes it moves. Or Northern California, I guess. To pair humility with power is to suggest that despite our physical nature, our entire being is filled with power, and therefore we are all filled with that infinite potential. We all have endless possibilities for that which we can accomplish in this life, because we don't have to have the power. We have access to all the power all the time. So Mary Cox Garner says this in her book, "Humility, then, is not to doubt your power. Rather, true humility is an admission that there is a power that works through us." This pure science of mind. This is what we teach. This is what we talk about every single weekend here and in every class we do. But when I think about that in a really personal way, what I realize is, because of the nature of our humanity, that everywhere we look, based on what we believe, you will always see reflecting back at you your own humility and your own power. So if you're not seeing humility, if you're not seeing power, then you know you can return to that place, like I call it love, the Course in Miracles says return to love, and stand anew in a bigger truth. Because if you're not seeing truth, you're basically seeing nothing. And I would add to that, that as I continued to look at definitions for humility, once again, the Urban Dictionary did not let me down. Definition there speaks to the call for us to be teachable. Can we learn new things? Can we acknowledge that we really are here to grow and to expand and remain teachable through all of that? And to just know, sometimes it's so wonderful to know I don't have all the answers. It's a really sweet place to rest for a little while. So when we use that word humility well, we're really speaking to the way it's possible for each of us to see the dignity of worth, the value of the human being, that we can see that in each other. And when we recognize it in each other, we call it forward to be more available on this planet. So acting with humility does not diminish our self-worth in any way. It should not, and that I don't care if that sounds a little preachy, because I feel it like a little sermonizing here. Humility should never diminish your own self-worth. It should instead affirm the inherent worth of all people. Big difference. And that takes us back to that Marianne Williamson quote that I read on the whatever day that was, where I was talking about the theological pretentiousness. That's such a beautiful passage on letting our light shine and helping others feel comfortable letting their lights shine as well. So I guess what I'm saying here is there is a way for us to get out of our own way. And when we get out of our own way, then that greater power, in whatever way you understand that power that's greater than you are, that power can then flourish. And it's not just to flourish in our lives personally, it's to flourish on this planet in tremendous ways so that we can begin to see the transformation that we all seem to yearn for so much. It is the way we are big for God. I love the words on the wall over here. It's about being big for God. Now, I got to tell you something. I'm working on this big project. I haven't been thrilled about it. Actually, I'm working on two big projects. One I'm really excited about. The other is like, oh, it's like been really not fun for me. Hugh said that he's never seen me sit and read a book and look so miserable before. But I have come to something that is new information to me that I'm looking to have a better idea about, so I can continue to be a good leader in an area where I have not had expertise from my past. So I got to study that stuff. So I've been going to workshops. I've been researching online and picking the brains of my colleagues and turning in book reports to the board. We'll be talking about it today, and it's been cumbersome. I will not lie. I would much rather stay over here on the project that I'm really having fun on and that's giving me good fodder for Sunday mornings and all of that. But I have to work on this big project. And so in the way I've been communicating about it, I've been trying to be sort of polite, but I've been going, yeah, I'm really wrestling with this stuff. Just notice I'm really wrestling with this stuff that I don't really want to be devoting so much time to. I want to be playing over here. I want to be looking at the vision of the future of this community and noticing what's showing up in my life, all the great things that God's sending me. But now I got to kind of put that on hold, and I got to be over here, and it feels like I'm wrestling with it. And one of my beloved friends said to me, I'm sorry that you're wrestling with that. And I realized when I heard those words, by the way, only because they were spoken not in a condescending way. If somebody said it to you in a condescending way, phew, you would not get it. But it was said out of love, and it was said out of compassion, like, I can really see your suffering. Maybe it was said like, I know, get over it, just do the work. I don't know. But it felt very loving. And so I took that and I went, wow, I know I have been using that term a lot. So the next morning I was meditating. And I had this complete, not a vision, but it was like getting information. Like, you need to study about Jacob wrestling the angel all night long, because that's what you're doing. You're wrestling with this angel all night long, and you won't let it go. So for a couple of weeks, and I want to confess to you, it's been painful. I've been so excited about it. I've wanted to share it with you for the last few weeks, but I knew I had to share it for this day because it fits so nicely with this material. So the story of Jacob wrestling the angel goes like this. So let me give you a little biblical background that might help you. If you can put it into a historical context, I wish somebody would have taught me the Bible that way. So I'm gonna give it to you that way. So Abraham, you know, there's that story in the Bible, that awful dreaded story, where Abraham is going to sacrifice his son Isaac. I've never been comfortable with that story. And fortunately, everything everything turns out okay at the last minute. He gets a divine message that he doesn't have to do this dreaded thing. But Isaac grows up and marries Rebecca, and Rebecca and Isaac give birth to these twins, Jacob and Esau. So just so you know how this fits with the book of Genesis and some of the Bible background. So I'm looking at the story. The story tells us that these two brothers did nothing but get into mischief together. They were always opposing each other, even in the womb. And one of the things I want to tell you that this story really reinforces for me as a metaphysical Bible teacher is that we do not want to miss the value of the metaphysical interpretation of the stories. And so when you see that there's all this historical content, because Jacob then went on to give birth to these sons who became the 12 tribes, so there's history woven into it, but the fact that we have a story about what goes on in the womb before these two boys are born tells us there's also some mythology here. And the mythology or the story in the story is so that we can reason on it and use it for our own personal growth. So you always want to be looking at the multiple layers of the information that's there for you. So when we're looking at metaphysical interpretation, one of the first things we do is we pay attention to what things are named and the names of people. So if you've ever used that wonderful Charles Fillmore Metaphysical Bible Dictionary, you can look up any of the Bible names and it'll tell you the symbolism of that particular name. Good thing to think about when you're naming children, though I notice most of us aren't in that category anymore. We won't be naming, well, hopefully I don't want to name any more kids. You can. And we do have some younger people that, you know, I mean, you know, you got, you know, you still, no, you never know. You never know. Wow, she said that. Now she got me wondering. All right, so the twins are in the womb. It's time for birth, and Esau is heading out first. Esau sees the light, and he's on his journey. He's going to get out first, because you know what happens if you're the firstborn? Woo, you get all the goodies. You know, you get all the blessings, you get stuff, and it's really a big deal in the Bible days to be the firstborn. But there's Jacob in there in the womb going, I don't think so. And he grabs on to Esau's heel, and he tries to, like, pull him back in or not let him get born first. But alas, we all know that process of birth, there's just no control in all of that stuff. Esau pops out, he's the firstborn. And Esau's, and he came out rather hairy. He had a lot of hair all over his body. Not like animal, but it does imply the symbolism of that, because his name means hairy one. Esau means hairy one. And the symbolism to that is that he of the two brothers was the more earthy of the brothers. He was a hunter. He grew up to be a hunter. He was very comfortable in nature. And so there's a lot of indication there that fits that idea of how we are to think of the son named Esau. Jacob, on the other hand, is born, and he is named, the literal translation of his name is the supplanter or the heel catcher. And to supplant is to supersede or take the place of. And through their entire lives, there is a theme of Jacob trying to get that birthright away from Esau, which he does. Effectively, in the end, he does. So all kinds of things happen. I mean, Esau is so worldly that he's out hunting and he's really hungry, and Jacob's got this stew cooking, and Esau comes in and he wants to eat. He's so hungry, and so Jacob says, hey, yeah, I'll sell that to you, but you got to trade it for your birthright. And Esau's so hungry, he doesn't care. He says, sure, and he trades it for his birthright. But then at the end, there's another little switcheroo that happens. It turns out that mom, Rebecca, loves Jacob more, and dad favored Esau. And so now and Isaac is very, he's blind, he's laying on his deathbed, they're going to bring him his last meal, and that's when the father is supposed to bestow the final blessing upon the firstborn son. So Rebecca gets together with Jacob, and they trick him. They put animal skins on Jacob's arms, and father reaches out, and he smells like an animal, like he'd been out hunting. And he eats the soup that's been made for him, and he gives the blessing to Jacob. And now Jacob has stolen the birthright yet again, as I'm not sure why it had to happen again. He already sold it for a bowl of stew way earlier. But at any rate, Esau comes in the room, learns that his birthright has been stolen away from him, and he's angry. He is not happy about any of this. And he's leaving town, and he threatens that he will return one day to murder his brother Jacob. So 20 years go by. By the way, this all happens in a little paragraph in the Bible, but you know, a good storyteller can. So 20 years go by. Now, apparently it's bothered Jacob that he has done this rather unethical thing, because he's basically a good person. And he wants to make amends. He wants to make everything right with his brother, and he's tired of living in fear. And so he sends messengers to go get Esau, and he's going to give gifts. He gives some gifts, and then he's going to give him more gifts. And now both of the brothers have become very successful in their adult years. So they have wives, and they have flocks and herds and camels and all kinds of things. And Jacob is hoping that he can soften up Esau, whom he hasn't talked to in 20 years, so that he won't kill him. But meanwhile, he has this need to protect his family. So they go out and they travel a little bit till they come to sort of a fork in the road. And he sends half the family and half the herds and half the everything they own in one direction, and the other half of the family he sends in that direction in the event Esau has so much hatred burning still that he not only wants to kill Jacob, but he wants to kill some of his family. He wants to do damage to his lineage. So that way, hopefully, some will remain. Some will live on. So he takes care of all of these arrangements, and then he finds that he's alone. Finally, after working this plan and putting things into place so he can make amends with his brother who he has greatly offended. And he's alone, so he has time to think. We can imagine that he prayed and he said and he grounded himself in preparation for what was to come. And somehow this man appears. Now here's where it gets really odd, and this is why I like to use a lot of different translations of the Bible. It says that a man came and suddenly and they're wrestling. Jacob is wrestling with a man. And in some of my Bibles, the man would be the M-M-A-N. It was capitalized. In other versions, it suggests it's an angel. But what we know is that by the time the encounter is complete, Jacob does declare that he has wrestled with the Lord, that he has had this experience. He even says, I've seen the face of God, and he fears because he has seen the face of God. So it could have been an angel. It could have been some divine being that was sent to represent God. We don't really know. And it was very common in biblical stories that angels would come to intervene in human situations, and they would even show up in human form. So what we know is that Jacob recognized this as something greater than just a human being. So the biblical passage says, so Jacob was left alone, and then a man came and wrestled with him till daybreak. And when the man saw the angel could not overpower Jacob, when the man recognized that he was not going to overpower Jacob, he said, "Let me go." So I got this vision. It's like wrestling, you know, he's got him pinned down, and the angel's like they're both getting tired. You would think all night long, it says, that they're wrestling. And he goes, the angel says, "Let me go. It's daybreak. Let us be done wrestling." And this is the important part of the story. It is what Jacob said to the angel. "I will not let you go unless you bless me." And the angel said, "Very well then, what is your name?" "My name is Jacob." And the man answered and said, "Your name will no longer be Jacob. From now on, you will be called Israel, because you have struggled with God and with men, and you have overcome. This is the part of the story that told me I needed to save it for this message today. Because as I looked this up in the Metaphysical Bible Dictionary, it said this. It said, remember that the soul, the growth of the soul is progressive. We must always be moving forward. The soul must meet and overcome its limitations. Jacob wrestled all night, and then he grew strong in his mind, and he knew a greater truth. He demanded to receive a blessing, and he got that blessing, and he was called by a new name. In one of my very good study Bibles, I found this note that said, strong character develops as you struggle through your conditions. So when God changes your name, it's symbolic of how God changes your life. So Jacob became Israel. He moved from being an ambitious deceiver into one who struggles with God and overcomes. Have you ever felt like you've struggled with God? Have you ever just had something going on in your mind that didn't make sense? Have you ever gotten so frustrated that you just put your demand on God? Humility, my friends, is a willingness to be strong for God, for truth, for what's right. Humbleness is when we have found a way to be big for God. It is the way we put a demand. We absolutely demand our blessings. We don't beg God for something that we don't feel worthy of. We wake up and we realize that we are created in the image and the likeness of, that we are co-creators with our own lives and in our own affairs, and that we can put our demand on the law, that we speak our word in these powerful ways. So we demand the blessing. We are inspired by our very challenges. Don't you notice how good it feels when you come out on the other side of a really tough time? We are inspired and uplifted by the challenges that we live through. And when we make that recognition, we are filled with gratitude in such a way that the song that you sang on gratitude, that's it. It's that kind of feeling where you can just feel it resonating inside of you. There is so much to be grateful for in this life. Marcus Aurelius was a humble emperor. His humility was seen in the way that he accepted his experiences. He didn't try and change them, but he stood as that stable place and that source of inspiration and guidance because he knew of that power that was greater than he was. He knew where the power came from. He did the work. He was not shy about doing the work. He accepted the challenges that stood before him, and he trusted that everything would turn out okay. When we get out of our own way, that power can flourish. But it cannot flourish when we play small. So the call for us, my friends, is to be bigger, to be bigger in such a way that we begin to embody what it means to be big for God, while at the same time, we remain teachable. And so I wanted to end this morning with this quote from the very beginning of the Science of Mind textbook. It's found on just a few paragraphs in. On the very next page after the opening in the chapter. And Ernest Holmes, the founder of this philosophy, was speaking to the teaching itself. Listen to these powerful words. I swear it's like I've never read these words before. When I saw them, it brought tears to my eyes. Let us approach the science of mind with awe, not with fear. with truly a humble thought, but not with a sense that we are unworthy. Let us approach it normally and happily, willing to accept, glad to experiment, and believing that as the result of our efforts, we shall each derive a great good and a sound understanding of the natural laws of life. Maybe true humility is intelligent self-respect. We have a lot to think about. And I'm so happy I finally delivered that message, because those are all the things I wanted to say today. So let's just get settled in and get comfortable right where you're seated, because I want to anchor these words in those powerful words of prayer. So take a breath. Take a holy breath. And for a little while, we sit still, quiet. Just allowing these ideas to touch us in a new way. To open our minds in such a way that as we renew our thinking, we are transformed. I feel the love of God within me, and I recognize that that love is a mighty force. And I know that there is a power and a presence in this universe that is absolutely greater than we are. It is a power for good. It is ever available. It is the Holy Spirit itself. It is that which heals and strengthens and breaks the bonds of limitation in every way. It is that which is our full and holy potential. I feel the love of God, and I recognize that it is the infinite intelligence of all the universe, that it is everywhere present. It is right here, right now. It is in this very room, and it is at the core of each being sitting in a chair. It is life. It is the activity and the movement of spirit itself. It is that wisdom in our bodies, in our physical being, that has that intelligence to heal what ails us. And so wherever there is an appearance of sickness or separation or sadness or depression, I simply know that right there is the fullness of spirit itself. That in no way can that power be diluted or diminished, because God is all. And God is all powerful. And God is everywhere present right here, right now. And I know that as we speak these words in this form of prayer, that we are activating that intelligence within us, that indwelling spirit itself is startled awake, that it is our way of demanding the blessing right now. And so we just open ourselves, we open our hearts, we open our minds. We allow our souls to be nourished this day so that we might flourish in that beautiful divine way. Not just for goodness in our own experience, but for the goodness of all of life. For the restoration of beauty and hope and peace on this planet. And so I know that wherever relationships have been strained, that this day, from this new experience of humility standing side by side with power, that we activate something so divine that we feel Spirit's healing balm just soothing us, mending us, returning us to our wholeness, restoring us to truth. And I give thanks. I am so grateful. For this indeed is a unique way to view life from a higher perspective. It is the way we can be big for God, blessed, inspired, grateful. And I am so grateful. I just say thank you, God. Thank you, God. Thank you, Spirit. Thank you, life. And feeling that gratitude in every cell of my body, I just release these words into the law, and together we say, and so it is.